Hi, Mark.
Hey Megan, how are you?
I'm pretty well. How are you doing?
I'm surviving.
Just surviving, huh? Is the housing market getting you down?
Well, no, we're halfway. I sold out 2 years ago,
Yeah,
and
you were one of the smart people who got out ahead of the bust, right?
well, smart or lucky, that's the question. But I was figuring by about now I'd be ready to get back in. Doesn't look like it.
Yeah, I've had the same thing. I'm sort of now in a position where I might think about buying a home because I think I'm going to be in Washington, D.C. for the long term. And you talk to all of the real estate agents, and they say, "Oh, prices aren't going down, and it's all fine." And my mother actually used to be a real estate agent. She's just shaking her head because it's so obvious in D.C. that they're still falling. Is the same thing happening out in L.A.?
I think so. Of course, it's hard to tell because when prices fall, the market freezes.
Right.
So you've got lots of high-priced houses on the market that haven't sold in 2 years.
Sticky prices, the bane of economists everywhere.
Right. So it's hard to tell, but I think they're coming down.
So what's your
I think
take on
more at the
what's
bottom of the market than at the top so far.
right. I think that's true here as well. Here what you see is people trying to rent things that they can't sell. Although of course
Right.
that just makes it, a year older and harder to sell next year, but I think people are still somewhat delusional, which I guess flies in the face of my, or it seems to many people to fly in the face of my belief that markets are efficient. I think you have something to say about that.
Yeah, I think I would distinguish between poachable and non-poachable markets. I mean, the stock market, everybody can be crazy, except the one guy who understands that he can sell short, and that will bring things into balance.
Right.
It's very, very hard to be short housing. And since people are living in their own houses,
Well, I
they're
guess
free to be
technically we are
delusional.
short housing, right? We're paying the carry to our landlord every month.
Right, yes. You and I are at least unhedged in the housing market. But it's hard to go any shorter than that, right? I mean, my conviction that not only did I want to sell my house, but I wanted to sell your house too, wasn't easy to act on.
Yes,
So I
I've
think
policed
those
have some
markets
very
are.
pungent words for people who try to borrow their neighbors' houses in order to sell them.
I think that's right. So I think those markets, because they're stickier, are more likely to be inefficient in the sense that you actually could make the right guess. I think selling your house when all of the executives of all of the housing, home building firms were selling their stock was not a hard guess. And on the
No,
other
and
hand, when I got to LA in 95 and the market had dropped about 30% and was now maybe 5% off its trough, it wasn't hard to guess that you should scrape together every nickel you had for a down payment. It
Yes,
just
I think
didn't.
that probably housing markets are much. I mean, and this is something that's true. I've been arguing about efficient markets hypothesis on my blog for the last few days, and there's a lot of, I think, misinformation about what the efficient markets hypothesis actually says. I think there's a lot of people who believe that what it means is that the market finds like the true best price, which of course
Right. All it means is you
you shouldn't
can't beat
fawn
it on
on.
average.
Exactly. But I mean,
Though
I
again,
think that
it's not
that.
clear to me, even in the stock market, why couldn't you have beaten the market by going short housing stocks when everybody who was running a home builder was selling?
I think it goes back to this thing that the market can stay irrational longer than you can stay solvent. Part of the information that people want out of the market is if they think it's in a bubble, and I agree that there are bubbles, and I think Eugene Fama agrees that there are bubbles, is that you don't know when the bubble is going to end, and that's an important piece of information in and of itself. And your
Right.
guess at when the bubble is going to end is no likely to be better than anyone else's guess. And so,
Right.
I knew someone in the stock market who made a killing in 2000. Because he was short all the major indexes, he was short everything. Unfortunately, he almost went bankrupt in 1999 because he had gone short in 97, 98, and 99.
Right.
And had it not crashed when it did, he would have been wiped out.
Right.
And I think that was the big problem for the housing bubble, is not that people didn't. I should say, there were clearly, as with any bubble, there were a lot of people, the James Glassmans of the world, who thought that it was actually going up.
Right.
I
Yeah,
was
in a
just
world that
fascinated.
contains James Glassman, why shouldn't it be possible to make money? Buy what he sells, right? Isn't that like a perfect guy?
Because you have to be able to guess where the herd's going, right?
I
Then that,
guess.
are you
But
likely
boy,
to
I
be
mean, I
better
gotta
at.
say, if I could go short American foreign policy, I certainly would today. I mean, if they can't find anybody better than James Glassman to sell it.
Is that amazing? That's the most amazing. Even I am flabbergasted. I'm flabbergasted anyway, because James Glassman and I are not exactly, kindred spirits on the investment front.
I love Paul Krugman's line about Glassman. You know, there was an extra digit in Dow 36,000, and let's just hope it was the 3 and not the 0.
Yes, I think the even James Follows, who writes for The Atlantic, which is the magazine I write for, likes James Glassman as a guy. But even he was like, this is like, you know, deciding to play me as the star forward on the Knicks or something.
Right.
Just because I really like basketball.
Does anybody have any idea what they were thinking?
I think my best guess, and I am I'm coming to the sad realization that I'm actually going to have to start paying attention to politics again, because no one wants to talk about anything else anymore. But I've been sort of blissfully just ignoring
Megan, they never did in Washington.
That's true, but it's getting worse even in Washington, and also on my blog. No one responds anymore unless I post something about, you know, how this politician is doing that or whatever.
Yeah.
But I'm sure you found the same thing, is that it's just that the heightened – people are just less and less interested in any topic that is not directly about, like, who's going to win the horse race.
Well, and it's it's not like unlike parts of L.A. where nobody's interested in anything but the industry.
Right, yes.
It's the mistake of having a capital that's just a capital. You know, if the capital were Philadelphia or New York, there would be people in it who cared about something other than government. And I think that would probably be good for the government.
Yeah, I actually have a surprising group of friends here. Not a lot of them, but at least some friends who don't do politics.
Right.
And I've been one of them. I do public policy, which is not quite the same thing. But I think that from my limited and back to the James Glassman question, I think from my limited exposure to these sorts of questions, the thing is that it's really hard to get anyone to take any position in the Bush administration, because it's sort of like lashing yourself to the mast of a burning ship.
Right.
And so they're kind of scraping pretty far down in the barrel for most positions. I mean, Hank Paulson is a welcome exception to that. And whatever you think of the new housing plan, I think Hank Paulson has been a terrific Treasury Secretary and really, like, pretty stunningly good at his job. But he's really been, in the second half of the Bush administration, the exception that proves the rule, that the good people want out as quickly as possible, because they don't want the taint of the Bush administration following the malodor following them through the rest of their careers. That would be my guess. I don't know.
I think Treasury is the one agency that even the Bush vandals have not been able to wreck. I don't know whether we're ever going to be able to reconstruct Justice. I mean, Justice was a very high performance, high morale organization when I was there, and for a long time after. And it's hurting for certain. And I think that's true of a lot of places in town.
Well, I think you have to give the Bush administration credit for trying with Paul O'Neill, but I agree. Treasury seems to be... I had a great conference call with them yesterday where it was a little weird. I was the only person who dialed into the conference call, so I suddenly had like five high-level Treasury secretary officials just sitting there telling me about the housing market.
Right.
Anyway, back to efficient markets and housing. So why didn't you short Toll Brothers, or did you?
I didn't. Partly for the reason you mentioned, partly because, though it's quite possible that somebody was smarter than the stock market, I certainly wasn't. I didn't pretend to understand how that thing worked.
I'm pretty skeptical that anyone is smarter than the stock market, but I'm very sure that I am not smarter than the stock market.
Right.
And I'm
right.
Very sure that the huge numbers of people I know... I don't even know is a strong word. The huge number of people I hear about who like to pick stocks they like to pick mutual funds, and they like to pour. It's like this sort of religious ritual, right? They like to pour over the annual reports and so forth. But they don't know how to read a balance sheet.
Right.
And they don't know how to run a regression, and they don't really have the underlying data on these places, and they like to do it anyway. And I've had angry conversations with people where they're like, but I, you know, this is important to me, and I really enjoy this. It's like, but it's costing you money. It's a really expensive habit. Couldn't you just take up fishing? Or
right, no, it's look, it's gambling.
It's, exactly.
And a lot of it's compulsive gambling, and it's I've always found it striking that when we discuss gambling policy, nobody picks up on Tom Schelling's comment from 30 years ago. The largest gambling enterprise in the world is New York Stock Exchange. And because people aren't aware that they're gambling, they do themselves a lot of damage.
Well, this gives the gambling gives me a lead into something I really want to get you on the subject on, because every time I talk to you, you're brilliant and I learn something fascinating, which is crime and gambling. What should our gambling, starting with gambling, what should our gambling policy be?
Given the existence of financial markets, it's pretty hard to control compulsive gambling. That is to say, I think the video poker machines are a tiny part of the problem. When I was growing up, my father had a good friend who was a druggist, who was a horse player, and had lost a fair amount of money in his marriage on betting on horses. So they finally persuaded him to stop betting on horses, and he became a stockbroker. And so, I don't think there's any doubt that the very short-term payoff poker machines and other video machines, the video lottery and so on, which I think somebody quite accurately compared to crack in terms of the very tight coupling between the action and the reward, I think that's probably likely to generate more psychological problems than anything that's slower, even the daily number.
I didn't mean to interrupt, but do you think that that's true of, I'm kind of, when I graduated from business school and I was freelancing, one of the things that I did was I transcribed earnings reports. And so I got to actually listen to this guy from Harrah's, who is, for business school students, he was a Harvard Business School professor. And he became the president of Harrah's, and he runs it like a business school case. You read everything that he does, and it really just sounds like a marketing case study.
Mm-hmm.
And so I actually listened to him on the phone talking about the stuff that they do to encourage what they call their avid gamblers, which is another word for
addicts.
People who are about to lose their houses.
Right.
And so he goes through all of these things, and a lot of them, I think, sound a lot like what you're talking about. They're these just sort of quick instant rewards for gambling, and if you gamble a certain amount on a night, I'm going to hand you a coupon immediately to go get some dinner or see a show and I remember sitting through this call and thinking, and I don't think that gambling should be illegal actually, but nonetheless, even I was sitting in this call thinking, and everyone's asking all these questions about, forward earnings, et cetera, and the loyalty program. And no one asked the obvious question, which was to me, how do you wake up in the morning and look yourself in the mirror and think, right, my job is to separate as many people from as much of their hard-earned money for as little effort as possible, and to get as many people who actually have trouble with this in trouble as possible in order to keep them going back to my casino.
Well, presumably, if he'd had any morals, he wouldn't have gone to work and lost wages in the first place. this is actually a quite general problem. Any activity that generates a compulsive pattern, gambling, drinking, use of other drugs, is going to be subject to a very strong version of Pareto's Law, where most of the activity is in people who shouldn't be doing it. So in the drinking case, half of the alcohol that gets sold in the U.S. is sold to people who drink four or more drinks a day on average year-round.
Wow.
And we're talking about serious problem drinkers. That's half of the booze. And the next 30% is people who average between two and four drinks a day year-round. So about 80% of their business is people who are drinking too much. And they say they're in favor of responsible drinking, they must mean that they're in favor of going bankrupt. Which is why I'm against legalizing any more drugs, even pot. I'd let people grow their own pot.
Mm-hmm.
But I really don't want to see what Anheuser-Busch can do with a drug that's more fun than beer. Because
do you think it's
you're in the vice
Busch,
business...
Though?
Hmm?
I mean, do you think that Anheuser-Busch has a significant effect on how much people consume? Most of the people I know, they may drink, very few people voluntarily drink Anheuser-Busch products, except insofar as they're cheap. But people I know who drink Hendrick's gin, they really like Hendrick's gin, and it's expensive, and they spend a lot of money on it. But they wouldn't drink less gin if Hendrick's weren't around, bringing this suave gin brand to them. They drink gin because they enjoy the sensation, the taste of the gin and the sensation that the gin produces in them.
Right, but remember, most of those people Right? I mean, so you got to distinguish between the typical drinker who drinks less than a drink a day and the typical drink that goes to somebody who drinks four or more drinks a day.
Right.
I mean, look, there are a lot of very smart people who work for the booze industry and the tobacco industry and the gambling industry. And they certainly know, since I do, that their business is creating, maintaining, and serving addiction. And I assume they know how to do their job. And that if they weren't doing their job, there'd be somewhat less addiction.
I guess I'm saying, I think that there would probably, like, if we all had to brew, I mean, even the heavy drinkers or drug users that I know or have known in my past, they had to go out in their backyard, grow the grapes, and then brew their own booze, probably they would drink less.
Right.
Just because it's, you know, efficiencies of scale, lower cost. I think wasn't there an interesting study that showed that actually, like, alcoholics are the most responsive to changes in the price of alcohol?
Sure, which is not surprising because it's so much of their budget.
Right. So that they will actually preemptively, if you announce like 3 months from now that you're going to raise the price of cigarettes or raise the price of alcohol, the social drinkers and the social smokers don't really do much. But alcoholics and heavy smokers will actually try to quit in advance of that because it's so much of their budget.
I know that hypothesis around. I mean that's the Becker Murphy Grossman hypothesis. I'm not persuaded by their methods, but it's certainly the case. Whether or not they're foresighted about it, they're certainly price responsive because they have to be, and therefore the fact that the beer industry makes beer extremely cheap matters. But I think
that
it also matters.
That I would say is probably true. That having in the same way that having a business that makes food affordable and easy to get makes us fatter.
Right. But also the branding. I think the branding matters. I think if people, I mean, we know that, you know, all mass market American beers taste alike because that's what the companies are trying to do. At the same time, they're trying to do product differentiation through marketing, and I think that if people weren't consuming an image as well as the beer, they'd consume less beer. I think knowing that you're a Coors fan or a Budweiser fan or a Miller fan matters to people, even if they can't tell one from another. I think the marketing effort probably matters. I'm not sure how much it matters now. I mean, alcohol is pretty well established. But I do think if you got a new vice on the market, the marketing effort would matter for it, and as we've seen with the state lotteries. And so I'm mostly against it. In the gambling case, I know what I'd do if I were in charge of preventing compulsive gambling in casinos or in the state lotteries. I'd simply require everybody who wants to gamble to sign up and establish a limit. If people didn't lose any more in Las Vegas than they went there intending to lose, the problem would be much smaller. And the problem is somebody gets on a roll, is $1,000 behind, and doubles up to try and get back to even.
Right.
And that you could prevent if you wanted to, but obviously neither the casinos nor the state gaming commissions want to prevent compulsive gambling because that's what builds those fancy buildings.
I have to say, I was in the position of having lost my credit cards in New Orleans and having to the credit card company FedExed me a credit card, but the debit company wouldn't, and so I had to go through the procedure that they make you go through in order to get cash out of an ATM in a casino, which was the only thing. I didn't have the PIN number for the thing.
Right.
And I needed walking around money. It was the most humiliating thing I've ever been through. I certainly I can't imagine that anyone who actually has a compulsive gambling problem manages to live through it, because it's so, everyone stares at you and they repeatedly ask you whether you have a gambling problem and if you've considered going to Gamblers Anonymous. I wanted money to go to Jazz Fest and buy oyster shells and patties. And,
right.
But so I guess my question then is why shouldn't we bring back prohibition?
For alcohol?
If alcohol is by far, right, the worst offending drug in America.
In terms of volume of damage, sure.
What?
In terms of volume of damage, sure.
Yeah.
Not even close.
Is it like, what are, I mean, like, because you know, you always get these comparisons, and for viewers who don't know, Mark is an expert in drug policy, so which is why I'm dwelling and asking him all these questions. What are the worst drugs in terms of, like, if you had to rank order, you know, best to worst drugs out there of the common ones? What are the least harmful?
You've got to distinguish between the harm per user and the total harm. So alcohol is probably not the nastiest drug in the world, but it does by far the most damage because so much of it is used.
Right.
I'd rank pretty far up, actually, on the nasty drug list. It's not easy to make the list because there are so many dimensions. Right. So legality, illegality is an important dimension. If you use an illegal drug, all sorts of bad things happen.
Right,
but
just in terms of the drug itself, you know, what the not obviously alcohol is going to show up as being terribly harmful because it's legal. Ditto, smoking is going to cause a lot of cancer because it's legal to use. But apart from the legality illegality of it, what are just the substances? I mean, if we're thinking about like rank ordering, which drugs should be legal, which shouldn't, which if any should be legal?
Right. There are at least three dimensions you want to worry about, right? So there's sheer toxicity, right? The drug that's most likely to kill you if you use it is nicotine in the form of cigarettes. Half the people who smoke are going to die early of smoking. And smoking basically doubles your mortality at any age. A really scary number. But that's all it's going to do to you. It's going to make you sick, you know, give you lung disease and so on, and quite possibly kill you. But it's not going to wreck your life otherwise. Right? There's nobody you know of whom the first thing you'd say about him to somebody that you were telling about that person is, oh, he's a smoker. But there are several people you know where one of the first things you can say is, well, he's got a drinking problem.
Yes, that's true.
Right? So nicotine's the most physically destructive because we take it in the form of cigarettes. If people smoke pipes, we much less so. In terms of bizarre and dangerous behavior, alcohol is probably the winner. Alcohol is the one drug which in the laboratory you can show generates aggression. It's actually not true of cocaine in the laboratory. The reason cocaine generates so much aggression is that people take it with alcohol. And the two molecules together in the bloodstream form a molecule called cocaethylene. And that does generate a lot of violence. And so people talk about the drugs, you know, one by one, which is a little bit artificial.
Mm-hmm.
So, in terms of bizarre behavior, alcohol and the stimulants compete, but they also combine with each other. So, it's hard to talk about them separately.
So, that would be amphetamines and...
Amphetamines and cocaine.
Cocaine.
And it's pretty clearly true that people who get in trouble with those drugs get in trouble more quickly than is true on average for alcohol. So if you look at the typical career life course of an alcoholic, there were a couple of years, maybe several years, of controlled non-problem drinking before you started seeing alcohol abuse.
Mm-hmm.
You don't get usually that much time lag for cocaine or the amphetamines, particularly in smoked form or injected form. Though the instant addiction story is nonsense, but it's clearly a faster addiction. On the other hand, heroin, which doesn't generate much, and both cocaine and the amphetamines are terribly toxic. I mean, somebody who's been a long-term heavy methamphetamine user probably has some cognitive impairments that are never going to go away. I mean, he's really actually lost some brain cells.
Mm-hmm.
It's also true of alcohol if you drink an awful lot of it.
But you have to drink an awful lot of it for an awful long time for that to be true, right?
Not so clear. There's some evidence that it's really the size of the biggest binge rather than the frequency that mostly correlates with cognitive loss. But, NIAAA is much less, National Institute on Alcoholism and Alcohol Abuse, is much less aggressive about proving that alcohol is bad for you than the National Institute on Drug Abuse is interested in proving that cannabis, for example, is bad for you. So I don't think we understand that as well. But no, there's no doubt the particularly methamphetamine has some pretty serious cognitive losses and other kinds of toxicity. I mean, they're really tough on the body. And for a long time, many of us thought, well, the good news is that they're so tough on the body that nobody can do these things for a long time. And that turns out not to be right. I mean, a lot of us thought, you know, crack addiction was going to be something people went through for 5 years. Mm-hmm. And it looks like 11 is closer to the median.
Really?
But none of that competes with heroin. If you take a population of seriously down and out heroin users, for example, from the criminal justice population, and look at them 40 years later, more of them are going to be dead than off heroin. There's a very famous study by Doug Anglin and his colleagues at UCLA looking at a group that was in the California Civil Addict Commitment Program, basically a drug treatment prison back in the 1960s. And because of a ambiguity in the law, some of the judges that sent people away failed to touch second base. So there are a whole bunch of people who were sent to this thing and cut loose by the appeals court a couple of months later. And there were essentially identical people who judges signed the right order and therefore were in the center for like 3 years. Mm-hmm. And Doug Anglin figured out, wait a second, we've got an experiment here. And has been following those two groups, the people who got kicked out at random, the people who had to stay in at random, for, I think, the last paper is a 42-year follow-up. And the first couple of papers were really encouraging. You saw big differences between the experimental group and the control group, even 3 or 5 years out, in terms of the level of addiction. And then you see the 10-year follow-up paper, and the lines start to come together, and after 15 years, you can't tell the difference. So in terms of sheer persistence in misery, heroin's probably the worst. It does generate a lot of bizarre behavior. It's not especially toxic for you. It wouldn't be especially toxic for you if you were taking it under legal circumstances. But heroin addiction is such a misery.
I find it bizarre because the first time I ever saw someone who was taking heroin, they basically showed up at my house, sat down, vomited, and then went to sleep. And I thought, that's not a drug I'd ever like to try. And since then, when I've taken opiates, they make me terribly sick. I've taken them only legally as prescribed for pain, and only been prescribed them a couple times. I can't imagine the attraction of sleeping and vomiting.
Well, so a couple of things. One is that people differ a lot in their response to opiates. Anything with fur, like stimulants, very few human beings don't respond positively to amphetamine or cocaine or caffeine. Mm-hmm. The opiates are different. Only about 25% of the population actually enjoys the opiates as opposed to getting pain relief from them. The vomiting tends to be a result of injection rather than taking it orally.
I got prescribed Vicodin when I had my wisdom teeth out. It was just like, I showed up at the doctor's office and immediately threw up. And I thought, I remember, this is what opiates look like.
Right. That's not all that common. But it's true that most of the people who have been using heroin for a long time aren't getting much joy out of it. All it's doing is staving off withdrawal. Whoever constructed the myth of Tantalus actually must have met an addict. Because that's the addicted life. You're surrounded with water and you can't ever get a drink. We talked to long-term heroin addicts, and they all say the same thing. Oh, the heroin on the streets today is just terrible. You know, when I was young, the dealers would give you good stuff, and now it's all garbage. Now, we know, in fact, that the potency of street heroin in the U.S. is up a factor of 10 over the last 20 years. And what's changed is their neurons. They'll never have that first experience again, but they'll chase it forever. So the opiates really are a special class, and that's the reason that for a long time people identified drug addiction with heroin addiction. And so cocaine didn't look like an addictive drug because there wasn't a marked withdrawal syndrome. So it turns out drugs that affect the brain are not a single category.
Right.
And they're dangerous on many different dimensions, so it's hard to do a clear gradient. I mean, I would look, I would tend to rate cannabis and the hallucinogens as much less dangerous on average than alcohol, the opiates, and the stimulants.
What about something like ecstasy?
Ecstasy is an interesting problem. So the early work on ecstasy says, oh, this is a non-addictive drug because it's got this fairly rapid tolerance buildup. Very, very unusual pattern of tolerance. Most drugs will form a tolerance. That is to say, you're not going to get the same effect tomorrow as you got today.
Right.
And if you've been using it for a while, you're going to have to up your dose to get the same effect. Right. So that's the usual tolerance pattern. In the ecstasy case, it turns out the tolerance goes not with heavy, frequent use. It goes with cumulative lifetime use. So that most people who've had six doses in a lifetime won't react as strongly to the next dose as they reacted to the first dose. And that doesn't seem to change either with time or with abstinence. And it's not dose reversible, right? If you know, once you've built up a tolerance for alcohol, that is say, learn to hold your liquor, you can still get stinking drunk, you just have to drink more.
Right.
Once you've sort of burned out your ecstasy circuits, whatever they are, increasing the dose won't do much good. So the good news was supposed to be, hey, here's a non-abusable drug. All the bad news is it turns out that people learn how to abuse it, particularly in the rave setting, the all-night dance setting, where the sheer stimulant effect that doesn't form a tolerance is still valued. So a lot of the people who are using lots and lots and lots of ecstasy three nights a weekend and doing themselves, I think, some real damage, aren't much getting the effect they used to get from ecstasy. In appropriate doses in appropriate settings and in infrequent use, it's an astonishingly reinforcing drug, probably with some large potential benefits. And that the tragedy with MDMA is that it was converted from a potentially useful drug for therapy or self-examination into just one more party drug. So it's very risky to people who, for whatever reason, really want to escape from their lives. For most MDMA users, the risks are negligible.
So back to the question, if alcohol is high on the list of nasty substances, would you agree that prohibition was pretty much a radical failure?
If you stress the pretty much, so what you see in the data from prohibition is a pretty big drop in drinking and in deaths from cirrhosis, which is a good measure of continued heavy drinking by long-term heavy drinkers. Mm-hmm. Cirrhosis deaths went down something like a half in the early years of prohibition compared to the pre-World War I era. Well, that's not a small change.
Right.
Of course, we weren't counting things like domestic violence back then. And one of the main reasons that the temperance movement was largely women was there was a perceived connection, I bet it was a real connection, between alcohol and domestic violence. So I think prohibition suppressed drinking in lots of the country and probably suppressed the consequences of drinking. Didn't work nearly as well as in the big cities where people were writing about it. And so prohibition, from New York's perspective, was not very effective because any New Yorker could get a drink.
Right.
From the perspective of rural Kansas, it probably worked reasonably well. It worked decreasingly well over time. It was poorly enforced and corruptly enforced. And so the availability of alcohol rose and its price fell throughout the Prohibition era. So by the time Prohibition was buried, the body was already dead and stinking.
So I would make the same argument about our drug policies that, I mean, as I think you've blogged, the street price of cocaine has been falling steadily for years. I mean, it's still higher than, I can't remember, someone I talked to was doing actual lab work with cocaine in, like, rats at Columbia, and he said it was either the lab price of the stuff when you're legally allowed to order it from the government, I don't know, it was either $10 a gram or $10 an ounce sounds too
low. No, $10 a gram is about right. The street price is $100.
Course, Right. So it's about 10, the street price is still 10, you know, 10 times what the lab price is, but the street price has been falling steadily basically since we started keeping the numbers.
Well, the street price collapsed in the early 80s and has continued to drift down.
So given that first of all, you've got a huge crime associated with the fact that there is an illegal drug trade.
Right.
And given that the street price keeps falling and that it's getting less and less, prohibition seems to be getting less and less effective over time because criminals spend a lot of time figuring out how to get around the law. Why should we keep prohibiting drugs if we don't seem to be doing a very good job of actually stopping them from reaching people? I mean, even in, like, my mother is from a small town in western New York, and even they have now curfews and hall passes and so forth because of the drug problems there,
mm-hmm.
Which definitely wasn't true 20 or 30 years ago.
Right. Well, so a couple of things. A factor of 10 difference in price in a drug whose consumption is, it seems to be, at least unit elastic is not a small impact on the size of the drug problem. The reason not to legalize cocaine as we legalized alcohol is we might have as many cocaine addicts as we have alcohol addicts. We now have a couple of million people in the country who are in trouble with cocaine at any one time. Probably got 15 million in trouble with alcohol. That's a big difference. And there's a belief out there that, you know, anybody who's going to be addicted is going to be addicted to something and it doesn't matter what. I'm sure that's not true. You could never be addicted to opiates. I could never be addicted to stimulants.
I could never be addicted to opiates if they keep making me throw up.
Huh? Right, exactly.
I have very strong feelings about things that make me throw up.
Right. So the more drugs that are easily available and socially acceptable, the more likely any one person is to find the drug that's going to be his problem. And so I don't think the number of addicts is at all a social invariant. I think it probably matters how many drugs are available and how available they are and what price. So prohibited cocaine is much more expensive than legal cocaine would be. And it's much more available. Look, you live in New York. I live in Los Angeles. Neither of us, I assume, travels in very druggy circles. I could get alcohol starting right now in 5 minutes. Presumably I could get cocaine if I really worked for it. But I wouldn't know where to start. Right? Could you buy cocaine today if I asked you?
I'm trying to think. On a 6 degrees of separation, I would...
Right. Right, but you know, if you drink, you don't have to worry about 6 degrees of separation. You go to the liquor store. So I think the effective price of cocaine, right, the dollar price plus the inconvenience of finding it, is high enough that it undoubtedly matters. So the question I ask both with cocaine, where I ask opposite questions with cocaine and alcohol. In the alcohol case, all right, we made it legal. Good for us. Are we having fun yet? What can we do now that we've avoided the submachine gun problem with alcohol? How can we avoid the alcohol abuse problem and the crime problem, and the drunken driving problem, and the hate crime problem, and the domestic violence problem? I mean, you look at things that are called hate crimes, about 90% of them are committed drunk. I mean, really, tipping over tombstones is just not that much fun if you're sober. So, I mean, what I'd say about alcohol is, let's get the price back up. We should have taxes that double the price of alcohol. Now it costs about $1 a drink, it ought to cost about $2 a drink. Alcohol is at least unit elastic. It's more elastic than that among kids and among alcoholics. So those are two good things. And people who drink and drive or drink and beat people up should lose their license to drink. Everybody should have to be carded. And if you aren't eligible to drink, that should be obvious from the face of your driver's license. In California, one of the ways they control underage drinking is if you get a driver's license and you're not 21, your picture is in profile rather than full face. So the bartender can look at your driver's license and not even have to do the arithmetic to know that you're not eligible to drink. Okay, so you got convicted of drunken driving. We're eventually going to give you your driver's license back because otherwise you can't get to work. But you should get it back with a picture in profile, and then you can't buy a drink. And I think people are going to be less willing to buy a drink for somebody who's lost his drinking license for beating somebody up than they are to buy a drink for somebody who's 20. So I'd get rid of the age restriction, I'd add a bad conduct restriction, and I'd push up the price.
On so the why not side, do something like that? Because my argument, like, I want to say I agree with you that I think that the argument that no one, if we legalize drugs, no one extra would do drugs, that's silly. I mean, if you reduce the cost of something, more people will do it.
Right.
You know, we might quibble about how many more people would do it, because in my experience, like, the people I know who have developed serious problems with either alcohol or any sort of drug are the people that I would have picked out, like, in junior high as being the people who were going to develop these problems.
Well, the science does not support that. I mean, maybe you're smarter than the average psychologist. But George Valiant actually did a cohort study. So he had data on people in college back when people didn't drink a lot in college. And followed them forward for 40 years and discovered that the alcoholics certainly had the classic alcoholic personality profile.
But what is that? Look, just
I'm not sure I can describe it precisely. There's a kind of magical thinking that goes with it. Right? I mean, the A line is that insanity consists on continuing to do the same thing and expecting to get a different result. And that's certainly a characteristic of alcoholic thinking. Anyway, there was described in the literature the alcoholic personality. Mm-hmm. And it was believed that it was people with the alcoholic personality that became alcoholics. But what you saw in the cohort study was not right. The alcoholic personality is what happens to people who have a long-term alcohol problem. If you look at them beforehand, you can't pick them out from the group.
Hmm.
So, look, studies aren't perfect. And maybe you're right. But I think it's probably the case that there's a lot of variance and that people who grow up in less alcoholic environments are less likely to become alcoholic.
Oh, no, I think that's true. I think more that, like, the people that they would have been among the code. They're people who sort of, like, were prone to things like depression and things where you knew young that, you know, they might want to medicate that, however. Or they tended to bounce off the walls a lot and need to, like, medicate that down. But I agree with you that it would increase. My thing would be just weighing the social costs of the prohibition. So why not then, say, have the government be in the business of if not actually just, you know, distributing cocaine, then and setting up these licenses where you can't get cocaine if you've operated machine or under the influence or what have you, or beaten someone up while taking it, you know, taxing the hell out of it, raising the price back up, but taking away all of these social costs of having enormous numbers of criminal enterprises that basically get, you know, spend a lot of time committing violence that wrecks not just their lives. I mean, it entices poor kids into this industry that for most of them is just a lottery they're going to lose, and they're going to end up living at home with their mothers and in jail.
Right.
And has huge social costs in terms of the violence and what the effects that it has on already struggling poor neighborhoods.
I think David Boyum has made this argument that cocaine prohibition is a good deal for the middle class and a rotten deal for the underclass. That the neighborhoods that are taking the most damage are the neighborhoods where people are being least protected from the problem, because, of course, the cocaine's available there. And the cost you'd see would be in much more prosperous places. And I think that's a legitimate thing to say. When I look at the state lotteries, I'm not thrilled with the notion of a public monopoly on cocaine distribution. It might be made to work. If it's sold at a sufficiently high price, of course, you'd simply get the illicit market again. So you couldn't have a licit price that was higher than the illicit price. And my sense is if you had it at the same price but lower social stigma and easier availability, you'd still get substantially more abuse. So I'd like to work that problem from the other end and say, how could we reduce the social cost of prohibition? And there I think we've got some fairly easy answers that we're simply not pursuing.
Such as?
Breaking up street markets using lower risk crackdowns. Right? So this is the High Point, North Carolina approach, where you identify the dealers in a street market, make cases against all of them, and then call them all together for a meeting and say, "Hi, fellas. You know, here's the felony case against each one of you. Here's the videotape. When you see yourself committing a felony, please raise your hand." Now, we've got lots of social services available for those who want them, but the market's closed. Any of you we even smell dealing goes away to prison. We don't have to buy from you again because we already bought from you. If you do that to all the dealers at once, there's suddenly no market there. And anybody who tries to set up shop stands up like a sore thumb and gets arrested. So that was tried, and they basically broke up a 20-year-old market with 5 arrests. The heavy cocaine users mostly have to commit crimes they get arrested for to support their habits. I mean, they're people who are rock stars or hedge fund managers or crooked lobbyists who can support their cocaine habit with more or less legal money, at least money they don't get arrested for. Mm-hmm. But most heavy cocaine users wind up stealing or dealing or hooking. So you can simply shut down on cocaine use among the criminal justice population, which you can do with frequent drug tests and a couple days in jail every time they're dirty. It's being demonstrated in Hawaii right now. You can greatly shrink the cocaine market and the crime associated with it without putting a lot of people in prison. And then I'd cut back radically on the sentences. I'd focus the tough sentences on people using violence or corruption or using kids as apprentice dealers or dealing in a way that disrupts the neighborhood. In New York, when the cops cracked down on street dealing, the dealers got cell phones. And apparently what you do in New York if you want cocaine or heroin is you call your dealer, and 30 minutes later a pizza delivery truck shows up at your door. So for the established users, the drugs are no less available than they used to be. But the market, the neighborhood impact is greatly diminished.
Right.
So we could have today's size cocaine problem minus some criminal justice folks who wouldn't be allowed to use anymore. And much
this
less.
This actually brings me to it because we should probably like move on and.
Yeah, we're not arguing enough.
No, we're not. But I was thinking like a broader question. Something that I've noticed is that crime isn't really an issue in this election. You know, I saw something yesterday about the Politico got a leaked document that said Obama used to be against the death penalty. Which, you know, from my point of view, is a feature, not a bug. But I think most of the American public still disagrees with me. But what's fascinating to me is that this really, you know, what I really thought in the end was, who's going to care? This is just crime, which I, you know, for certainly through the 96 election was this hugely salient issue, has just kind of disappeared from people's radar as something that certainly at the national level they're particularly interested in. I mean, would you agree with that?
I think that's right. I mean, not surprising, crime's down close to 50%.
Right.
I think that was actually an issue on which, in some ways, the public was closer to being right than the academic and political elite. Crime was a huge issue. And I'm sad we solved it in a fairly stupid and brutal way. But that was probably better than not solving it.
Do you think that we did solve it, or that it was just abortion or demographics or one of these other solutions, these passive solutions that have been offered?
Yeah, I think the abortion evidence is only so-so. The lead evidence is actually pretty strong. I think probably the biggest anti-crime measure of the last half century was getting lead out of gasoline. The impact of lead on intelligence is very strong.
Hmm.
I mean, you probably have a 5 or 7 point IQ edge over me simply because you're younger.
I wonder if that explains some of the Flynn effect.
It certainly explains some of the recent change in measured cognitive performance, but the Flynn effect goes back to 1850. I mean, I think Flynn is right. It's essentially the intellectual stimulus provided by the environment, much more than, certainly nutrition and environmental protection, including from things like lead, matter. But I think there are other things than that. Lead also has direct effects on behavior, increases impulsivity, and so on. So if you looked at lead, you'd say, oh, this is a heavily criminogenic substance, and we've really gotten rid of it. I think smarter law enforcement accounted for some of the drop. I think just more law enforcement accounted for some of the drop. There are heavy positive feedbacks built into this because as crime goes down, the pressure on the remaining criminals goes up. So there are now three times as many burglars in prison as there were in 1980. And there are half as many burglaries, which means the average burglary now costs you six times as many days behind bars as it did in 1980. Now, if people are at all price responsive, that ought to matter. So I think it's a complex of things that happened. But
yeah,
since almost all the public discourse about crime was stupid and in favor of nasty, unproductive policies, I'm happy that it's not salient. Same thing with drugs. Salutary neglect is probably a good approach both to drugs and crime at the moment. The professionals in the crime business are getting smarter, and probably the less jostling they get from the politicians, the better.
It seems that in the case of drugs, it's really just been replaced by immigration, so I'm not sure.
No, that's right. That's right. I mean, the social critics who talk about moral panics are clearly, they're clearly on to something. Though having identified something as a moral panic doesn't mean it's not a real problem. I guess immigration
is
the new crime.
Dragging it back to the election, because we know that's what sells, right. Giuliani is probably going to, one of the things I'm sure we're going to see in the campaign is him taking credit, we already have, really,
right,
for New York's amazing crime drop. What's your take on that? Many people would argue it's Bill Bratton and Giuliani just sort of ran in front of the camera as Bill Bratton was pulling off a major success. But what do you think? Is that
far be it from me to say anything nice about Rudy Giuliani, who's the most dangerous candidate for president of my lifetime, and I lived through Nixon. But Bratton didn't appear out of nowhere. Giuliani picked Bratton, and Bratton was a non-obvious choice. And
do you think really Bratton really made the difference that he claims?
He made a difference. There's no doubt. There's no doubt. I mean, yes, crime dropped everywhere in the 90s, but it dropped further and faster and for longer. I mean, crime is down in New York every quarter since Phil Bratton took over as police commissioner. And he made a lot of institutional change that's still there. The Compstat system is a really good idea. And it's an interesting question to how many other public services we could apply it. I mean, you need good outcome measures, and you need outcome measures that are quickly responsive. So No Child Left Behind is sort of anti-Compstat. I mean, it's exactly the wrong way to measure and reward progress because it's too slow. But if you wanted to do Compstat for education, you'd give every kid a laptop and have computer-scored exercises every day so that the principal could call the third grade teacher and say, what's happening to Johnny Smith's reading scores? They plateaued for the last 2 months. What are you doing about that? As opposed to getting an average statistic for the classroom at the end of the year. I mean, that does no good at all.
Has anyone even tried that kind of approach?
I think there have been some experiments. I mean, education is not my business. I think there have been some experimental studies on that that show progress. There's also the whole classroom discipline problem, which turns out to yield to fairly straightforward interventions. And there's some experimental work going on that. But if education were as progressively managed as policing, all the reading scores in the country would be a grade higher.
One thing that's heavily in the news right now that I think is technically still your provenance is the D.C. gun ban, which, of course, is like particular salience here because I'm now living in D.C., and it does have higher crime than New York did, which kind of surprised me, I think. It's smaller, and certainly my mother just moved down, and she's shocked at the level of crime here. So now, of course, the D.C. gun ban comes along and has got everyone up in arms. And you've actually you're an interesting case for me because you're definitely liberal, and as far as I know, don't shoot guns or. But you a couple years ago wrote a great post, basically saying that the evidence really seems to be a wash. That freely available guns seem to neither increase nor decrease crime.
Freely available guns in the hands of people who aren't criminals, neither increase nor decrease crime. Keeping guns out of the hands of criminals is a worthwhile thing to do, and hard.
Right.
And harder because they're so available to everybody else. If we could have a British or German or Australian level of private gun ownership, we'd have less homicide in this country. I mean, the U.S. no longer leads the world in crime. For most crimes, Western Europe is substantially worse than we are. It's gone from half our level to twice our level since 1970.
Does anyone have a good theory of why that is?
Six of them. Not of many good, as far as I can tell.
But we're still the world leaders in homicide, right?
We're still the world leaders in homicide because we're carrying all these deadly weapons. I mean, things that used to be fistfights are now murders. And in Europe, they're still fistfights.
We've had the guns for two centuries. Michael Bleel having been pretty much ripped down. We've always had.
We've always had a lot of rifles. Mm-hmm. But rifles don't kill that many people. Poor criminally active kids having handguns is relatively new, right? I mean, as late as the 60s, there were zip guns, that is to say, homemade gun substitutes for kids who couldn't afford guns. The crack market took care of that. It provided both the money and the motivation for lots of kids to arm. And, of course, once your playmates were armed, you better be armed. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, keeping guns away from criminals is a good objective. And there's some things you could do about that. Keeping guns away from ordinary citizens is of no particular significance. It'll cut down on homicide, right, if that were your concern. But it's not mine. So I would propose a grand bargain on guns where the gun fans get what's called shall issue, so that if you want a permit to carry a concealed weapon and you meet the qualifications, you have no criminal history, and you went through a short training course, it must be issued to you. It's not discretionary in the local police chief.
Right.
That's what the pro-gun people want. I'd give them that. I'd give them the right to carry interstate. If you've got a license in Georgia, you should be able to take your weapon to Nebraska. And in return for that, I'd want a more aggressive gun tracing system, taking the shackles off alcohol, tobacco, and firearms in terms of computerizing its records so they can go after the scofflaw gun dealers. I'd want a ballistic signature program so guns are fired first, so that anytime you find a bullet, you can figure out which gun it goes back to. And most important, I'd want to close the private sale loophole. So if I go to a gun dealer to buy a gun, he's got to run a background check to make sure I'm not a convicted felon or domestic violence perpetrator or somebody who's been committed for mental disease. But if you have a gun, you can sell it to me lawfully without ever finding out whether I can lawfully buy it. And something like 40% of the handguns sold in the U.S. are sold in private rather than store transactions. That's the famous gun show loophole, which of course doesn't exist because there's nothing you can do at a gun show you can't do anywhere else.
Right.
Just that gun shows are where those transactions often take place. It's easy to fix. All I have to say is if you want to sell your gun to me, we have to call a gun dealer and have him run a background check. And, you know, we pay him $5 for it. I mean, there's no rocket science about that. So in return for that package, I'd be happy to give up shell issue and national carry. I can imagine selling a President Obama on that deal.
Despite his stated support in 1996 for gun control, along with abolishing the death penalty.
Right. I mean, there are people who are in favor of gun control because they think it will reduce homicide. And there are people who are in favor of gun control because they think guns are icky. and you know, the part of the gun control movement is the liberal version of the drug war. Right? This is culture war. Right?
Right.
We disapprove of those guys with the Confederate flags on their trucks. And since they like guns, we're going to make guns hard to get because screw you. I don't get the sense that Obama is, in his heart, a culture warrior. And that being the case, I think if he can be shown that that package I just mentioned will control crime better than the package we now have, he might buy it. And it's even possible to get it through the Congress.
I think the problem is that, and you know, as a pretty avid gun rights supporter myself, is that I actually like I've long been an advocate and gotten skewered for it by people on my own side of that people should have to, it should be like a driver's license that you should have to get, you should have to prove that you know how to point and shoot the thing, because I have seen morons with guns, you know, on the first time on a firing range. And frankly, I don't want someone out who has not really internalized the message, like, you know your target, don't point it at anything you don't intend to shoot, always assume it's loaded, etc. I don't want those people out on the streets with a gun until
I see your Darwinian convictions are just not very deep.
Well, unfortunately, I'm worried about what Darwin might do to me
right.
With their gun. But that, you know, even as an I might be able to sign on to that kind of package, but the problem is, and I think it's legitimate, it's just as with the other side of the abortion debate, right?
Right.
A lot of the things about abortion aren't really, like, it's hard for me to get, I'm pro-choice, but it's hard for me to get really excited about parental notification. I just honestly, like, you know, except in the cases of where you've got a kid whose family will disown or something, where there should be a judicial override. It's hard for me to get excited about the notion that, yeah, if I had been 15 and pregnant, I would have wanted to have an abortion without telling my parents, because I wouldn't have wanted to confront my parents with it. But I shouldn't have had an abortion without telling my parents, because my parents aren't psychotic freaks who would have turned me out of the house. There were people who could have provided me the kind of emotional support that I would have needed to get through that kind of very difficult time and help me make this decision, and maybe it's easy for me because my mother's a huge Planned Parenthood supporter or whatever. But, right. But in general, I think like no.
But you're assuming that there's a class of young women who will make the wrong choice, not be talked out of it by their provider, and presumably a competent abortion provider is going to say to a 15-year-old, "Well, you know, can we help you talk to your parents about this?"
Well, I think though that for a lot of kids, right, the decision to have an abortion is a decision not to tell your parents.
Right.
And that's not the reason that you should have an abortion, so that your parents won't find out, in almost all cases. If that is the case, then, like, you should talk to a judge, et cetera, and there should be a mechanism for getting beyond it. But the fact is, most kids don't want to tell their parents that they've been doing something they shouldn't have.
Right.
In the same way that, like, I wouldn't want kids to be doing extreme things to their bodies in order to avoid telling their parents that they'd been caught drinking.
Right.
The fact that you don't want to tell your parents is not a reason to have a fairly major procedure that's, you know, I think, not to talk about whether 15-year-olds should have babies or anything, but I just think, like, not getting your parents involved in the process is not a reason for the state to recognize a right for you. The fact that you don't want your parents to know that you're having sex is not like, a judiciable right that the state should recognize. You know, you can't go out and get your belly button pierced without your parents knowing. There's
right.
Most things you can't do without your parents knowing, for the good reason that we've decided you're not old enough to be in charge of your own life yet.
Right. My view is that anybody who's not old enough to be in charge of his own life is not old enough to be in charge of a baby. So I'm pretty absolute about negative reproductive freedom, just because I don't want to deal with the kids.
But my main point on this is, right, that I think that most pro-choice people, this is not actually things like a spousal notification law, parental notification law, the partial birth abortion ban, in and of themselves, they're not that big a deal. And
right,
if
but they're
there
part
was
of a
feeling
slippery
that the parental notification, for example, was really something that, like, conservatives cared about in and of itself and wanted to stop there,
mm-hmm.
they would not fight it that hard.
Right.
I mean, they would probably still fight it,
right.
And I understand the reasons. I'm not saying there's no valid reasons to be, but it's just not something. But in fact, what they feel completely legitimately is that this is, for pro-life forces, a way of just continually inching forward towards an outright ban.
Exactly. He's like, no, I think the analogy you're drawing is exactly correct. In each case, there's a core interest that people want to defend. They see a slippery slope toward a complete abolition of that interest, and they're going to fight, you know, to keep the outworks. So I actually hope the court finds a Second Amendment individual right to keep and bear arms, take that one off the table, and
right.
I think actually may make the gun control problem easier to solve. This is Eugene Volokh's claim, and I think he's probably right about that. Yes, if you made everybody get a license to have a gun, then you'd have, I think, concerns. You know, that when the NAFTA highway is driven by the New World Order to take the Trilateral Commission in charge of the country, they'll then have a list of all the gun owners they can go execute.
But it goes back
think,
to this really
I don't
is
think we actually need that.
War.
I don't think we need that.
Like, if I lived in a pro-life community, a pro-choice community, I would be okay with the parental notification law.
Right.
Because what I would feel is that this is really a thing of, like, we're trying to protect kids who might go and do something that they would later regret, whatever it is, have the baby, not have the baby,
mm-hmm.
because of some sort of family dynamic that is just a normal family dynamic of children. At least
right.
me, I was, like, hugely secretive and didn't want my parents to know anything I was doing, much less that I was doing something they disapproved of.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is, because you live in a community that's partly pro-life, you know, it's a battle against those people. And similarly
right.
with guns, it's a battle against... I mean, I think it's actually... If I lived in a totally supporting gun rights community, I would be totally okay with having a license to...
Well, no, this is just for concealed carry, right? I'm not insisting on that for ownership.
I would actually institute a license to have a gun.
Mm-hmm.
In the same way that, like, if
right.
you're planning to operate a car...
Right.
You should. I think you should have to have a license to buy a car if you're gonna drive it. Like, if you're gonna have a gun in your house, you should have to prove that you know how to shoot it and take
right.
the safety off and put it on and load it and unload
yeah.
it and all of those, like, basic. But that's what the license would consist of. It would consist of proving, I am familiar with the operation of this piece of equipment.
Right.
I'm not gonna randomly kill someone because I'm just a total moron.
And actually, you could devolve that down to the gun dealer as well. So the gun dealer has to do a background check and has to certify that he's. Check the person out.
Right. But
and then
the,
you don't
the
have,
problem
then
is...
Then you don't have the list of gun owners.
That's the thing, is that I then have a legitimate fear that because there are people who want to ban guns, that the list is just going to create a list
no.
that they will then use
right.
to come and take all the guns away.
That, well, and so partly the constitutional thing would fix that, but partly if you devolve it down to the gun shop, right, then there is no list.
Right.
Just as you could do the... You know, Al Gore lost the presidency because he called for gun registration. Everything you want from gun registration in terms of law enforcement, the ability to find out who last lawfully owned the gun that you found next to the corpse, you can get with gun tracing. And so you decentralize the records down to the gun shops. So
I think
there is a politically viable compromise that gets you almost everything you want in terms of reducing homicide.
From your lips to God's ears. Maybe we could finish up with something that you talked about, wanting to talk about, which is Robert Frank's Luxury Fever, which seems very appropriate this holiday season.
Yes, indeed.
As I'm bombarded with invitations to buy excessively expensive electronics.
Right.
And other things to show off my wealth.
Have some wealth now. I mean,
I don't actually. I'm invited to show off my putative wealth, which sadly is mostly invested in my new sofa.
Right.
But I'm saving it. You know, I'm putting it away for the grandchildren, so
right.
they'll have the sofa. But you brought it up. So why don't you shoot on Luxury Fever and?
Right. So I think Frank makes 4 points, all pointing in the same direction, which is that. More wealth, that is, being able to satisfy more of your material preferences, doesn't, at a social level, make people happier. If that's right, then lots of microeconomics and lots of microeconomic-based policy analysis, which is what I do for a living,
mm-hmm.
sort of flies out the window. But I think they're all pretty good points, right? So he starts with the Tibor Sotoski point, which you can actually find back in Xenophon, that people acclimate to levels of consumption and therefore only enjoy themselves when they're consuming better than they usually consume. Right. So in the hero, here the tyrant says to Simonides, the wise man, no, no, you're wrong to think that tyrants have the good life. Because what's the good life? Right? It's dressing up in your fancy clothes, having a feast, and having sexual access to people of superior social status. And if you're a tyrant, well, you never have a feast because that's your everyday meal. You never dress up in your fancy clothes because that's your working uniform. And there is no one of superior social status to have sexual access to. So it's really a boring life. And then Satosky, you know, adds a lot of psychology and neurology to that. But if that's right, if you take the matching law seriously, then giving people unlimited resources to satisfy their preferences won't, in fact, maximize their well-being, because they're gonna maintain too even a tenor of consumption. Right? Having an occasional feast is much better than eating a big meal every day. And you know, there were times when there were social and religious reasons to have a feast. But that's hard, or not to eat a lot when you weren't having a feast. That's harder and harder to enforce. So,
I would have to challenge. I think there's a really good paper, and I forget his name. I just tried to Google it and couldn't find it. But it's a paper called My Pain, and it's written by an MIT economist who specializes actually in these sorts of behavioral economics questions. And one of the things that he's tried to do is he's a burn victim. And so he's lived his entire life with disfiguring scars, pain from lingering pain from the scars. He has to manage all of these things and his limited physical mobility and all of these things. And he says, you know, look, I self-report at the very high end of happiness. A lot of the data that Robert Frank uses relies on this. And it's really hard to see how you would get some other kind of data, but I self-report at the high end of happiness, but do I think I'm as happy as I would have been if I'd never been burned? No. In fact, like, I'm in pain and it hurts. But I just, right. I'm taking that baseline and saying, like, well, this is as good as I can get given that I have these burns.
Right.
You know, I'm really lucky that I have this awesome wife who married me despite my burns.
Right.
I have all of these things that I have, even though my baseline is lower, so I self-report as a high level of happiness, but that doesn't mean I'm actually as happy as I would have been. That
how hard that experiment is to do.
Oh, I agree, I mean, but I think
certainly he knows that he would be happier if he woke up tomorrow morning without the scars and the pain. Mm-hmm. And that's certainly true. He'd be delighted. He'd be euphoric for 6 months. And the question is, when he eventually went back to baseline, would it really be a higher baseline? Now, in that case, the answer is probably yes.
Yes, I would say. Or think about a model that, say, Americans can understand of the dictator. Think about the most popular kid in high school or college. So this guy gets all of these things, right? He's usually fairly wealthy. His parents enable him to afford a high level of eating and drinking. He has sexual access to the highest status women on campus. He has almost no responsibilities, and he's looked up to by everyone. So he's got this enormously high status. Now, when he leaves college, we all at least fantasize that this is true, but I think, like, in many cases it actually is true, that those people peak young.
Right.
My mother was talking about going to her high school reunion and finding out that all of the these people had sort of ended up, like, working in the cafeteria, and that, in fact, they were kind of happy because they were the kind of people who were fairly content with what my mother thinks of as fairly little. But at the same time, they're not as happy as they were in high school. They're conscious of the fact that they peaked.
Right.
And that's
completely built into the Satosky model, right? That's his whole point. That every time you consume something you enjoy, you're raising your baseline and therefore making it harder to get enjoyment in the future. I mean, his account is that pleasures, that is, say, things that are positively valued when they're present, turn into comforts, things that are only negatively valued when they're absent. And so, yeah, and that seems to support the story that says, you know, it really wasn't a favor to that kid for him to be so successful in college because there's no place to go but down. And so one implication of this is it's useful to have a rising consumption bundle over time.
Well, that's the Benjamin Friedman argument, right, is that people, if they don't have a rising consumption bundle, people can have a rising consumption bundle one of two ways. You can have a rising consumption bundle relative to your neighbors. In other words, you can be in a static economy, mm-hmm. Or even a shrinking economy, but as long as my relative position is changing, I'm better off. But you can also just have a rising consumption bundle relative to what you used to consume.
Right.
And that is, as long as one of those two things is rising, you will actually become not only happier but nicer. Mm-hmm. You will do more of the things that we think about as moral, like mm-hmm. you'll give more to charity, you will be less racist, you will be right. nicer to your spouse or whatever. And as long as those things are falling, as soon as those things start falling, you get into trouble.
That seems completely plausible, but it's true at any level, right? So on the one hand, not everybody can be taller than everybody else, except you. So that's a problem, right? Everybody will report being happier with more money. That's right. But if they're reporting that only because they have more money than someone else, then that's a zero-sum game. And yes, you can have rising consumption bundles over a life course, but that's pretty independent of whether the whole economy is growing or not.
Well, but I think you have to challenge, first of all, I mean, assuming that it's actually there's some utility out of being taller, which I might dispute, it would be very utile for me if everyone else got taller because it would be easier for me to find clothes and like fit into airline seats. I've toyed with the idea of moving to the Netherlands solely for this reason because
right.
everything's big there.
Well, there may be an important sex difference on this dimension.
But in general, you know, there is a benefit to men to being the tallest.
Right.
But there are also just benefits to being taller, right? There are, you can get things off higher shelves, or you can, this goes against everything that I blogged today, where I blogged that there are negative externalities right now to being tall.
The negative externalities, there are also, I mean, my sense is that if, you know, everybody were 2 inches shorter, everybody would be better off. I mean, the shelves would be shorter too.
But I can maximize my apartment space.
Huh?
In a way that, I remember like when I lived in Chicago, my boyfriend at the time was only a couple inches shorter than me, but he came over and he couldn't get stuff. I mean, he was like 5'11 versus my 6'2. But I had stuff on the top of cabinets he couldn't get.
Right.
And that
well,
was clearly...
If everybody were shorter, the cabinets would be shorter, right? I mean, that seems to me doesn't go through. There's really no advantage to being larger unless there's saber-toothed tigers around.
No,
it's
created
larger,
extra
absolutely.
Vertical space.
Huh?
I mean, all of the space between my floor and the top of my cabinet was already used with shelves.
Mm-hmm.
This just added like an extra shelf that short people simply couldn't have.
I suppose.
So it actually did create
Look,
utility.
Look, compared to the burden on the back and the knees and the heart.
Yes, and my feet.
I don't think there's any doubt that socially we'd all be better off shorter, but individually we're all better off taller. I mean, at least the males are better off taller.
Women are better off shorter, sadly.
But I think, you know, wealth is the same way. So Frank makes four sets of arguments. There's the Xenophon-Sadovsky argument that you get used to it, and therefore there's not much percentage in everybody getting richer. There's the Veblen argument that says you compare your consumption with other people, and therefore, again, there's no... It's better for me to be richer than you, but not for me to be richer absolutely. There's Frank's, I think, original argument, which is it's not merely that you're comparing your consumption to other people's, you're comparing it to some social baseline. So insofar as you're satisfied with having a good something, that status of goodness isn't absolute, it's relative to whatever else is out there. And finally, and this is the important point, that not everything is consumed competitively. So that there are some things where we could all get better off. We could all have a shorter commute. And we'd all be better off for having a shorter commute because I don't care to compare my commute to yours. We could all have better health care. Again, probably not competitively consumed. So
except for plastic surgery.
Hmm?
Except for plastic surgery.
Except for plastic surgery. And yes, plastic surgery is the interesting counterexample there.
But right. You know, I will get back to this and argue that I think it's hard to, for example, plastic surgery. I remember there was this show on Fox News a couple years ago, maybe five or more years ago. It was called The Swan, and it's really horrifying. They take these women and they make them lose weight, and they give them plastic surgery and like dental implants and all this stuff. And you start watching it and you think, this is just gross. I'm watching some sort of grotesque American circus.
Right.
But here's the thing. Over time, they took women who were literally disfigured. I mean, there were women who, they took one woman who, like, when she was growing up, they called her the witch because her nose was so long and mm-hmm. spiky. And another woman whose teeth had just all come in weird. And were just sort of not an attractive color. And nothing that you would think in any of these cases, oh, the state-run healthcare system will take care of it, right? They weren't, they didn't have a cleft palate or something, but they all had things that were, not all of them, but many of them had things that were severely wrong with their face. We're not talking mm-hmm. about, like, getting cheek implants. We're talking about fixing major things that made them pretty hideous.
Right.
And at the end of it, you saw that, in fact, this plastic surgery had taken women who were at the very bottom end of the distribution, made them normal or even, you know, above normal. And so, in some sense, that's a competitive good, right? They're just truncating a distribution. But in some other sense, like, being able to truncate the distribution and move the bottom tail up, given that we're actually evolutionarily hardwired to enjoy beauty, not merely as a positional good, but also as a, right. Like, an absolute standard.
Well, I don't think there's any doubt that, it's certainly plausible that you could reduce the absolute number of people in the population at whom other people look and go, ooh, ick. Right? One possibility is that the ooh, ick is simply the bottom 5% of the distribution, whatever it looks like. But I find what you're saying completely plausible, that there may be an absolute rather than merely a positional good there. But that's the analysis that Frank urges us to do, to understand that there are some things like bigger TV sets that we probably don't enjoy absolutely, and other things that we do, and insofar as we can shift our economic activity toward producing things that are absolutely enjoyed rather than positionally enjoyed, we'll get happier for the same amount of stuff. Now, that sort of wrecks most of what I know about economics, but it seems to me likely to be true, at least substantially true.
I think that for me, it goes back to the fact that, like, it's very hard for me to establish. I think that on a personal level, I actually think this is true, right? The high I get from buying a new gadget is short-lived, and I buy too many gadgets because I enjoy the high. That said, it's very hard for me to establish on any kind of macro level which of those gadgets is that for which people. I mean, if you're a huge sports nut, you may get, like, huge utility out of having this gigantic television
right.
that for me would be something shiny to hang in my living room that I would admire for 2 months. But for you might really actually change, really up your utility. And so that, I think,
that's something then we should encourage people to learn about themselves.
Hmm.
I mean, the point is, the proposition that if you just let people maximize their current preference, they're going to do well, may not be a very good approximation once we're as rich as we are now. And Frank actually provides some interesting examples. So he lived in a community where some people had spent a lot of money on a house with a nice view. And other people had spent the same sort of money on a Chagall for their living room. And he reported that the people with the view still were really into it 5 years later, and the people with the Chagall said, you know, it was great to have, and now it's wallpaper. I enjoy it when somebody else comes over and looks at it. Well, that's an important thing for people to know if they're going to spend important money on one of those two things.
Right.
So I think he's pointing us toward a whole new set of inquiries and away from a set of assumptions that are
more objects.
Hmm?
I think what it points to ultimately, right, is that when you buy an object, in the same way that when you buy a stock, you should be pricing the expected future cash flows.
Right.
When you buy other objects, that you should be trying to price the expected future utility flow.
Right.
And that we need a better set of metrics for evaluating what things have high future utility flows. But
right.
And I'm not against that, but I am against the idea that many people have put forward that therefore we should just tax the hell out of people with high incomes because they don't really enjoy them anyway. And we're preventing people from this positional race that makes them deeply unhappy.
Well, I don't think we would change the positional race much. But I do think it's likely true that the universal belief among rich people that they'd be happier if the government would only stop taking money from them, it's probably false.
But one thing I've learned about myself is that I tend to run on in blogging heads, and then Robert Wright yells at me. So I think we have to wrap this up. But it's been great talking to you, and have a merry, non-luxury, feverish holiday season.
Same to you, and I hope we can do it again.
Yes, absolutely.
Thanks.
Take care.
Take care. Bye.